A meeting will come to order. This is January 12th. Welcome to Education Innovation Policy. Our agenda today is placing the rest of the introductions at the end of the presentation, so I hope that does not disturb some of you who came expecting to be first on the agenda. I feel that the presentation by House Research is the most important thing we learned today, so please forgive me if that has disrupted your plans. I know that Ms. Aberholden has gone to the Senate and will be back here toward the end of the meeting, so I think things will work out. We have a quorum present. The committee legislative assistant has checked the roll. And members, would you look at the minutes? Not just look at them, would you read through them? And I would suggest you save these if you want to remember all of those who have presented so far from our audience as interested in helping us with our education innovation policy modifications, changes, new bills, continuation. Representative Bennett, have you moved far enough through them to approve, please?
I have, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Bennett moves approval of the minutes for January 10th. Is there any discussion? Hopefully all spellings are correct. We tried very hard to make sure that we made those correct. So audience members, if you found mistakes, please let me know because we can always make technical changes. Hearing no discussion about changes or amendment to the minutes, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those who do not approve, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Today is an overview of a variety of jurisdictions that we have in this committee, the Minnesota Department of Education, the Board of Teaching, the Purpich Center of the Arts Education, the Minnesota High School League to a certain extent, and then I've asked Ms. Pera also to present other education topics. So this is an overview. There's not testimony taken during this members or those in the audience. This will be Ms. Pera presenting and members being willing to pose questions if those so arise. And so in your packets, members, and I know available to the audience, are two green folders, both of which Ms. Pera will use in her presentation. She has presented a PowerPoint, so the PowerPoint is in the folder where you see the Department of Education schematic on their organization. And then the other has a series of, maybe it's just down to two, no, it's three different position papers that were prepared by the Office of Legislative Auditor with the advice of legislators on audit topics for 2016 that we will be hearing the results of now in 2017. So they include standardized student testing, the Purpich Center of Arts, and the Minnesota State High School League, which was a very narrow audit. So we will hear those as those reports are issued. And then next week on Tuesday, when I present the report of the study group on teacher licensure, you will also receive at your places the audit, the complete audit report that was delivered to us in 2016 on the Minnesota Board of Teaching and Minnesota Teacher Licensure. So look forward to receiving that on Tuesday. That's something you will keep. We have enough of these original copies for you, so that you can move through those as I review some of the items in it as I present the report. So that'll be next Tuesday on our agenda. You've probably already received that and seen it posted. And then we will hear from the Board of Teaching in response to the report and to get an update on some of the business that they have been conducting according to current law. So with that, Ms. Pera, will you go to the testifying stand and prepare to present. And members, I think Ms. Pera will point out to you what she wants you to have in hand as she begins. Welcome to our committee. It is so good to have you, Ms. Pera, already working so hard for us and doing such a great job of already preparing a PowerPoint, members. This is no easy task when the chair asks for an overview and a brand new House researcher does such a splendid job in providing us with that good basic information. This, members, is also going to help you better understand this afternoon's joint meeting, which is in Capitol 120 for audience members as well. We will convene at 1 o'clock with the Education Finance Committee. I know many of you are not on finance, so if you want to get excused or try to get excused from your 1 o'clock meeting, do so in advance and join us there in 120 when the commissioner will present ESSA, the Educational, the new act, Every Student Succeeds, act which was passed by the Congress and signed by President Obama in 2016. And this information that you're getting at the beginning of this presentation, I think, should help lay the groundwork and give you a basic understanding. So I'm sorry, Ms. Pera, that I interrupted my welcoming of you, but as that thought came into my mind, I thought I should remind members. So everyone, 1 o'clock, Capitol 120, so you can come there right after session. Welcome again, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christina Pera. I'm from the House Research Department. I work with this committee, and I'm part of the education team. My colleague Tim Strom is also in the audience, and he works with the Education Finance Committee.
Pages, would you check to see that her microphone is adequate? And while the pages are standing, at least Isaac and Stephanie, oh, here we are. We weren't even live. Isaac and Stephanie, at least today, are our pages. That may change, but welcome, Isaac and Stephanie. When we have permanent pages, we will have formal introductions. So if you two continue with us, we'll hear more from you later. But thank you. We need to have the audio, and we need to have this going. Does that mean the beginning of our meeting was not recorded?
It was picked up on the recording. It just sounds
as thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Pera, why don't you introduce yourself again and begin?
My name is Christina Pera. I'm with the House Research Department. I'm the K-12 Education Policy Analyst. And I'm available to work with all of you on any research matters, any legislative drafting that you'd like to work on. So I'm just going to go through the presentation. It's an overview, so I'm not going to go very much in depth with anything. But certainly, if you have questions about anything, you can ask me questions now, or we can talk later about that. So. These are the topics we'll be covering: the Department of Education, school districts and boards, laws, rules, policies, some of the other education agencies, the Purpose Center, the state academies, the Board of Teaching, High School League, and then also assessments. And I know a number of you expressed interest in career and technical education on Tuesday, so I thought I'd just talk very briefly about that as well. This is just kind of an introduction, some statistics about education in Minnesota. We have 328 public school districts, four intermediate school districts, and I'll talk a little bit more about that and about the special education cooperative districts. Over 2,000 public schools, 165 charter schools, and over 55,000 full-time equivalent teachers. The Minnesota Department of Education, that is the state agency that's generally responsible for overseeing education. And you have in your pocket packets kind of a flowchart showing how the department is organized. You see the commissioner there, and then various assistant commissioners and offices within the department. The Department of Education was established by the legislature. It's in a few chapters, 119A and 127A. The commissioner is appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate. The commissioner is charged with the execution of powers and duties to promote public education in the state and to safeguard the finances pertaining thereto. So the commissioner and the department have a variety of duties, including reporting to the legislature on state laws and rules, supervising the public schools and educational agencies, and the issue of administrative rules. I think it's helpful to keep in mind that how Minnesota is different from other states. Most other states have boards of education, and sometimes that's provided explicitly in the state constitutions. They're organized differently. Sometimes members are elected to those boards. So I think that's helpful to keep in mind as you start to think about sometimes the federal laws, for example, ESSA, to think about how the federal and state systems interact there. I won't go into the finances, but I thought it might be helpful just to have kind of a glance at that, where their money is coming from, state versus federal, and also what the money is spent on. See this pie chart here, spending by category. Department of Education, this is generally what they oversee. It's not an exhaustive list. They have supervision over academic standards, adult basic education programs, early learning programs, and there are a variety of those, including ECFE, which is the Early Childhood Family Education Program, the Early Learning Scholarships, Head Start, et cetera. Also charter schools, career and technical education, grants, licensing, a little bit about licensing, and I'll talk more in detail about some of these as we go on. But reports, rules, special education, testing. I want to draw your attention to the data center on the Department of Education website. There's just some information there that you might find helpful. There's the Minnesota report card, which has data for public schools and districts in the state, things like demographics, test scores. There's also the statewide longitudinal educational data system, SLEDS, which has data, again, test results, percentage of high school graduates enrolling in college. And then there's the early childhood longitudinal data system. I believe that's a newer tool, but if you can see things like the number of kids in various programs like CCAP, that's the child care subsidy program that's administered by DHS. The ECFE, district preschools. So that can give you kind of a good picture of what we're doing around the state. As I said, the Minnesota Department of Education, like other state agencies, issues rules. So the legislature passes laws. The temporary and local ones go in, or uncoded ones that goes into the session laws, and then the ones that are more enduring or general go into the statutes. Both of those can have directions to the agencies, whether it be how to distribute grants or what rules the agency should issue. And the legislature can limit the scope of the rules that the education that the agency issues. The agency has limited rulemaking authority in that way. And the rule, a rule is an agency statement of general applicability and future effects. So it's how the agency is going to implement the law. And agencies have to follow the Administrative Procedure Act when they issue rules. Generally, it means notice and hearing, but it can be a lengthy process. And so the legislature can also instruct the agencies to use an expedited process for that. It still allows for notice and hearing, but it allows for that process to go through on a shorter timetable. If you're interested in knowing more about that, I can point you towards some resources, or I can talk to you about it. There are also agency statements, which are not rules. They're not formal rules, but sometimes the agency will just talk to the public about how it's administering certain programs. And agency rules are subject to review from all three branches, from the executive. The governor can veto all or part of a proposed rule. The agency itself can amend or repeal a rule. The legislature can also review those rules, can amend it or repeal it or limit an agency's scope, the scope of the rules that it can issue. There's procedures for investigating and objecting and also for delaying the effect of a proposed rule. Wills can also be challenged in court. For example, if somebody wants to bring suit, arguing that rules go beyond the scope that the legislature authorized or they're unconstitutional. And thereby petition also. Local governments and persons can petition for to have those rules repealed. Generally, the education statutes, you're going to find those in chapters 120 to 129C. And the rules, the Department of Education rules will be in chapters 3500 to 3560. And the Board of Teaching, which I'll talk a little bit more later, those are in 8710. School districts are governed by school boards. And again, one thing to keep in mind is that in Minnesota, school districts have a lot of authority over education. That's not the case in other states. And I'll talk a little bit more about the relationship between the departments and the school districts and schools to kind of illustrate that later. But the school boards have authority over curriculum, collective bargaining, they manage funds, make decisions about levies, they have policies, they hire the superintendent, they have advisory committees to advise on the curriculum, and generally they conduct the business of the district, which means they have implied powers in addition to the specific powers granted by the legislature. World's Best Workforce, that's in Section 120B11, and I bring that up when I'm talking about school districts because the school districts are required to develop plans and budgets to implement World's Best Workforce. That's legislation from, I believe it's 2013.
Correct.
And the idea is to make sure Minnesota students are prepared and are making progress. There are five goals that need to be part of the district's plans relating to school readiness, third grade students achieving grade level literacy, closing achievement gaps, making sure students are career and college ready before they graduate from high school, and that all students are graduating from high school. So the school districts are responsible for developing plans, setting benchmarks, evaluating student progress, instruction, curriculum, making sure teachers are distributed equitably, et cetera. So you'll be hearing more about that, I'm sure. The department oversees special education. There are federal and state requirements. This is not in the slide, but there's currently a big decision pending before the U.S. Supreme Court on special education. It's unclear how it will affect Minnesota, but that's just something you might be hearing about, and I'm happy to talk to you about that. We also have intermediate school districts in the metro. There are four intermediate school districts, and that's a joint school board set up by the local school districts to meet the low instance needs of special education students. They have a physical building where students go, and they also have staff that go to the school districts, the member school districts, to the schools in those school districts. In other parts of Minnesota, there are special education cooperatives, and those are similar. If you're interested in learning more about special education, we can talk more about that. There's a couple of years ago, the Office of Legislative Auditor issued a report on special education as well, and those are very thorough and have lots of information for you. Charter schools. Charter schools are considered public schools. Minnesota was actually the first state to pass a law for setting up charter schools. They are exempt from all statutes and rules that apply to schools, school boards, or school districts unless the statute or the rule is made specifically applicable to the charter schools or it's included in Chapter 124E, which is the charter school chapter. Charter schools do get general education revenue as well as other revenue. The Department of Education, they're involved there in things like working with authorizers for the charter schools and some other things. So to give you kind of an example of how all these systems work together, for example, Section 120B.02 requires the commissioner to adopt and rule statewide academic standards, and then other sections go on to identify what subject areas those are, things like math, language arts, science. So the commissioner issued rules with those graduation standards in Chapter 3501, and those are broken down by both subject area and by grade. And then the districts put standards in place. So they develop local standards for subjects that don't have state standards. World languages is a major one, also career and technical education. Those are things that the district does, not the Department of Education. The districts have an advisory committee to make sure the public has input as to the development of the curriculum. So it's really the districts that develop the curriculum that choose teaching methods. But then there are also school site teams that develop practices to improve instruction, and they also work with the advisory committees. So that's an example of how you go from the statute, from the legislature to the agency rules to the districts. We're going now to the Purpich Center. It's the Lola and Rudy Purpich Center for Arts Education. Their mission is to provide all Minnesota students the opportunity to develop and integrate their artistic and academic abilities to their highest potential. And that's just a picture there of the high school in Golden Valley. The Purpich Center was created by the legislature in 1985 as the Minnesota Center for Arts and Education. It was later renamed. They operate the Purpich Arts High School in Golden Valley, and they conduct outreach and provide support to schools statewide. They also, a few years ago, started operating the Crosswinds Arts and Science School in Woodbury, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. They have a biennial budget of $22 million. They have their own chapter in the Minnesota statutes and also their own rules chapter because they are their own educational agency separate from the Department of Education. They're set up, they have a 15-person governing board. The governor appoints members to that board subject to Senate confirmation. The board has authority to manage and control the center, including hiring employees, executive director, who's the administrative leader, and staff are considered state employees. This is an overview of their budget. Again, and I should say these are from the MMB agency profiles, which have a lot more information if you're interested. You can look at those. So the Purpich Arts High School, it's a residential public high school for 11th and 12th grade students. It's on a 33-acre campus in Golden Valley. They have a residence hall for those students that are coming from other parts of Minnesota. They have concerts, exhibitions. It's free to attend, but there's the room and board component, and some families do receive financial assistance to support attendance. The class of 2016 had 102 students, so it's a relatively small school. And they had 100% graduation rate in 2016. As I said, they also a few years ago started operating the Crosswinds Arts and Science School. It was which was previously part of the East Metro Integration District. When that integration district was going to stop operating the Crosswinds School, the legislature transferred authority for Crosswinds to the Purpich Center, and it now operates as an independent school district. And so year-round middle school, grades 6 to 10, is focused on integration and diversity. It has a curricular focus, though, on art and science. Purpich conducts a number of statewide activities, as it is required to, providing statewide professional development, other services. It works with four school districts around the state that operate as regional centers. And those include then districts within a 60-mile radius. Professional development, arts camp for educators and teaching artists. They recently started doing a workshop with Hennepin Theater Trust to support teachers that have theater responsibilities after finding that some of those teachers didn't have experience with that. And also work on arts integration facilitating the development and implementation of arts integrated lessons. They've had some issues in the past few years, things like declining enrollment, some staff turnover, some complaints from parents, crosswinds, and so in. Last year, the Office of the Legislative Auditor announced that it conducts an audit, and there is a handout in your packets giving some more information about that and outlining the three issues that it should look like this. The three issues that that will be evaluated. It's generally governance structure and processes, leadership strategic goals, and how well it's monitoring the performance of the center, how well it's fulfilling statutory goals, statutory requirements related to arts education, and how well it's managing the crosswinds transition. And I believe that report is expected out pretty soon. Next is the Minnesota State Academies. It's the State Academy for the Blind and State Academy for the Deaf. And that's a picture there of the Academy for the Deaf, I believe. Their mission is to create opportunities and motivate students for an independent future. The State Academies were founded in the 1860s. It also operates as its own agency, which means it's separate from the Department of Education, separate from the Purpich. And it functions as a public school district with two schools, the Academy for the Deaf and the Academy for the Blind. They have students from 75 school districts around Minnesota. The academies are in Faribault, so they have a residential component for those students who are coming in from other parts of Minnesota. And they do have nursing staff in the dorms. They are funded through biennial appropriation, and again, they also have their own kind of section in the statutes. They're governed by a 9-member board that is named by the governor. They have a new superintendent. The campuses are a half mile apart. There's a road that actually connects the two. And they have shared services, the two schools. They share a central administration, human resources, business services, nursing, food services, et cetera. They are funding through direct state appropriations, there's a special education formula for that funding. They also can build back for unreimbursed costs for one-to-one staff. Some of those students have very high needs that can be expensive. Here's just an overview of the budget, historical spending, spending by category. The State Academy for the Deaf, they provide services from early childhood through high school. They teach both American Sign Language and English. They have a transitions program where students can learn home living skills. They can do community work. There's job-related skill development. There are athletic activities for students. There's a performance space. And their enrollment has been growing. Last school year, they had 89 students. This year, they have 105, and I believe they expect that number to actually go up by the end of this school year. The State Academy for the Blind serves students ages from birth through age 21. They work in academic skills, communication, orientation, mobility training, social skills, independent living, provides career education. They also have athletic activities, and they work on developing some of those life skills in the dormitories, things like cooking and grooming. A lot of special education services. And their enrollment has also grown. The 2015-16 school year, they had 41 students, and this year they have 60. They conduct a number of statewide activities, things like summer institutes, trainings for students, also professional development for teachers, and promote educational programs offered by the school districts or other organizations. They work with the school district on things like assessments to determine what students' needs are and other statewide activities. And move on to the high school league. The high school league, they provide educational opportunities for students through interscholastic athletic and fine arts programs and provide leadership and support from member schools. They are not a state agency. They are a nonprofit corporation. It's a voluntary association of public and private high schools. Even though they're not a state agency, they are subject to various state requirements, and I'll talk a little bit about those. They don't receive any direct funding from the legislature, but some of those state requirements that I talked about, they're in Chapter 128C, so they have their own chapter. They have several boards. The member schools delegate control over certain extracurricular activities to the league. There are about 525 schools, over 300,000 students. Their board of directors has 20 members. The regional assembly has 48. And the regional assembly is kind of like their legislative body. They enact the bylaws of the league. They have 16 region committees and as well as advisory committee activities. The governor appoints four of the 20 members of the board of directors. All must be parents. The Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals appoints two.
Be addressed through the audit. And we have had previous audits, but we look forward to the response to what the auditors found out, so that we can make sure that this great school we have, the Perpich Center for Arts Education, is operating as we have statutorily asked them to operate. Are there any questions on the Perpich Center for Arts? Representative Ward, do you want to make any comments since you're the one who instigated the audit?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee and guest. I'm really looking forward to this report, and I'm hoping that we can all be present to hear what's happening and the recommendations that the auditor will be making. The focus is to make it the school that it was intended to be, with the vision and the operational opportunities to provide arts education and integration for the entire state, all the students of the state, and support for teachers. I think we're going to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward, and thank you for that initiative, because it is always very good that we have transparency and accountability for a school for which we spend $22 million on very specialized education for our children. And we also want to make sure that our children are getting the best possible education. Standardized student testing will be released later this year from the OLA, but you will notice that under the discussion, they took a two-pronged approach. And I know they're compiling the data right now, but they conducted statewide surveys to gather general information. They conducted in-depth case studies in a few school districts and charter schools to better understand local circumstances. They interviewed MDE testing and accountability experts. And we have very good testing experts at the department. They interviewed the vendor representatives. Pearson is our vendor, and other key stakeholders. They analyzed key documents, statewide data, and reviewed relevant academic literature. So this is comprehensive. So we will learn a lot from the standardized student testing audit report. And they also have indicated in this discussion that they asked questions also of usefulness, spending, and administration. And that's my phone. Isn't that ridiculous? I never bring my phone in here. It's ringing. Oh,
it's beautiful, though.
Yes. It is very lovely. Somebody unknown calling me. Isn't that disgusting? So that I really do look forward to that, and I have had no peek at the report. And in fact, I haven't had a peek since I'm the chair of the Audit Commission at any of these. So I think we can look forward next week to the Perpich report. Is that true, Mr. Hasek? Possibly, yes. Next Thursday, I believe we'll hear that. Then the Minnesota High School League was a very narrow audit that Representative Dettmer requested, and I do believe that is being put off as a finalization until after the High School League has met and perhaps changed some policies. The concern from Representative Dettmer, again, was about participation from, you know, certain groups of our students who may be denied the opportunity to participate. You will notice that we had a change, as Ms. Pera presented a couple of years ago, which was a result also of Representative Dettmer's interest in ensuring that students with disabilities were being able to participate across district lines. So we look forward to that. Are there questions from members? So with that, just a reminder, we have the joint meeting at 1 o'clock in room 120 of the Capitol. Session is afterward, not before. I was misdirecting you. And you'll probably have a caucus. I know we have a caucus before session, so we shouldn't have to run back here and then go to the Capitol again when now we have those wonderful caucus rooms in the Capitol before we go to session. A reminder also that they're going to televise that joint meeting in room 120. But you will have to be excused if you are not on finance, so please take care of that so that your chair knows if you're not going to be present. Are there any questions about that? Let's proceed then to hear from others who really help us a lot in the realm of education policy, who are in the audience today, who did not get to speak on Tuesday. And we'll begin with Paul Spies from the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. Mr. Spies, welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Committee Members. My name is Paul Spies.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Wabi Burnett.
We are with the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota, and the collection of school districts, higher ed institutions, community organizations, agencies, professional associations are all united around this goal to diversify the teacher workforce. And we thank you, Committee Chair Erickson and other members of the committee last year and members of the House for passing legislation that created the expectation that students have equitable access to effective and diverse teachers that represent their diversity in the schools. As you know, our diversity in Minnesota is increasing in our student population. So we have over 700 members in just a year with 150 different organizations. And we have a handout here for our platform. We take a comprehensive approach to address major barriers. And Madam Chair, I'm wondering if we can hand this out to
the pages will attend to that.
So Robbie will just briefly describe, list the five major platform pieces that we're going to be bringing legislation forward to consider this session.
Again, thank you for your time this morning. The goal of the coalition is to increase or double the amount of teachers of color and American Indian teachers within our state by the year 2020. Currently, we are at approximately 2,200 or 3.8% of all teachers within the state of Minnesota are from diverse racial backgrounds. And so our goal is to ensure that at least 20% of those teachers in teacher preparation programs and in pathways are persons of color and American Indian individuals to address and meet our goal of increasing our diversity of our teacher workforce by 50% by the year of 2020. As you can see in our platform, we have a comprehensive plan in addition to five key strategies to help us address these barriers in order to meet our goal. The first bubble you will see is the yellow bubble, which is to address the transformation of the climate and curriculum in pre-K through 12 schools and college and universities. The green bubble is associated with providing scholarship incentives, student teaching stipends, and loan forgiveness for teachers in service. The orange bubble addresses the elimination of discriminatory teacher testing requirements, as well as examining our current teaching structure, which I believe is the NES basic skill system. The red bubble is addressing induction and retention as it relates to maintaining and keeping effective teachers in our classrooms that reflect diverse backgrounds of our state. And our last bubble, the blue bubble, is talking about supporting pathways for getting diverse youth, as well as paraprofessionals who are currently already in the schools, as well as career changers, individuals who may decide to become teachers in their later life. So creating more pathways to increase that pipeline to get more actual effective teachers into our state that are from diverse backgrounds. On the back page, you'll see that there are additional in-depth details supporting each bubble that I will leave for you to peruse at your leisure.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Sherry Munyon from what was used to be Adult Basic Education, now representing Literacy Action Network. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Sherry Munyon, and I represent Literacy Action Network, and this is the adult basic education providers that are in all of your districts. And this is an opportunity to provide adults with the educational opportunities they need to become participants in the workforce and wage earners. The services that are offered range anywhere from your basic literacy skills, English as a second language, GED preparation, adult diploma, and college readiness programs. One of the nice things about these programs is they are very readily able to respond to local needs. And so in some communities, there may be an influx of immigrants, and ESL is a priority. In others, there are changing employer needs. And then there is interaction between adult basic education, workforce centers, and employers. And in those cases, we have seen programs able to develop certificate programs for adults who have achieved basic literacy skills. And they're able, in some cases, to achieve a certificate for nursing or a certificate as welders and meet the unmet employment needs. And the other programs that are starting to move forward are for the higher level learners, and these are the college readiness programs. One of the significant programs in St. Paul is an interaction between our local ABE provider and St. Paul College. And this has mutual benefits because the college sees the benefit of not having to educate adults on the basic skills before they get to school. For the employers, they find college-ready, college-educated students. And for the students themselves, they do not have to pay for college credit courses that really are not, or college courses that are not credit eligible. So that's a quick overview of the different programs. We'll look forward to meeting with all of you individually, and I may be joined by my colleagues Shep Harris and Nancy Hilden. We are collaborating on a program for the legislative session.
And Representative Ward has a question for you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Munyon, I'm just delighted with all of the programs for adult basic education and the opportunities that you've just described. Do you also know anything about the connection that some districts are making between ABE and early childhood family education, connecting the ECFE to these adult learners?
Ms. Munyon.
Madam Chair, this is a critical issue because, of course, if we have literate adults, literate parents, they can better work with their children. And so that has been a focus and is an ongoing issue for our families.
Very good. Thank you for the question. Thank you very much. Sue Abderholden from NAMI. Welcome. This is our mental health organization, everyone, so we want to pay attention.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we are holding Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're a statewide organization that works to improve the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families by providing education, support, and advocacy. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or have a family member. We are, of course, very concerned about children's unmet mental health needs really impacting their ability to do well in school. There's a couple of things that we'll be looking at this session. One is to continue to increase the school-linked mental health grants that are really viewed as a model across the nation. We don't think it's the school's responsibility to provide actual treatment. We think that really does belong with our mental health providers. But what we do is co-locate the services so we're actually able to eliminate barriers that families have in getting their children to mental health treatment. Consistently over the years, we've seen that half of the children have never received treatment before and half of them have a serious mental illness. So we know that this is really an important program in terms of early identification and treatment. We are not yet in 50% of the schools. We're around 42%, so we know we have to do more there. We also believe we need more school support personnel. They play a very important role, not the clinical role, but the other role in terms of helping children who maybe, you know, just are experiencing some problems in their life but don't need a full-blown diagnostic assessment and treatment. We have worked for many years on reducing the use of seclusion restraints in the schools, and I will say that the schools have done an amazing job, really committed to this issue. But what we know is we have some very complex children. Mm-hmm. Their needs are extremely complex. They might have very aggressive behaviors, and frankly, no one knows what to do. And so what we need to do is have, you know, a little pot of money where they can bring in an expert on that child's particular diagnosis to really help them be safe in the school. The other thing I wanted to mention is that we have not done as well in early childhood mental health. We have children who are being kicked out of daycare. There is a program, a small program through the Department of Human Services. We think that needs to be expanded to be really able to help those children. We're also looking at what we're calling the at-risk code that Oregon has. If you have a child, for example, that's been exposed to a traumatic event, perhaps it's a child from a culturally diverse community, doing a full-blown diagnostic assessment before you can actually start the treatment is really difficult. Some of the questions really are quite sensitive. And so what Oregon has done is allowed a certain number of visits to take place to really help that child, and they may not then need to go on to treatment. So, again, it's a way to provide early, accessible treatment without having to do a full-blown diagnostic assessment. I wanted you to know that we are, as a state, at risk of losing all of our Medicaid funding for our children's residential programs. I know that you've heard particularly from the intermediate districts about they have kids that really should be in residential treatment. We have a new plan that was passed in 2015 to create what we call psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which could be Medicaid funded, but our current residential service may lose all of that, and we don't want, frankly, that part of our system to go away. I also want to let you know that we are really having a problem with day treatment programs. We definitely need more. We'd like them to be more integrated with the schools, but the biggest problem we're having is transportation. We have some schools that do not want to transport children to day treatment, and we're also beginning to have problems with our prepaid medical assistance, managed care, where they're saying if there's anything about day treatment in the IEP that they will not pay for transportation. And yet we know these children don't belong in the regular classroom, so we need to try to address that issue. I also wanted to say that last year you did pass legislation requiring, you know, each teacher to know if a child had actually heard a teacher. And one thing I'd like you to think about as we have been looking at this issue is, does a child ever get a second chance? So what if a child in first grade injures a teacher? That record then goes on through their entire school period. And you all know you kind of look at a child perhaps a little differently if you know they've injured someone. So does that go on for their entire education career, or after 2 years and they've not done anything else, do we get to kind of wipe that slate clean for them? So something I'd like you to think about. And then lastly, I am a member of the Discipline Task Force. I think we are finally making some headway in terms of the beliefs that we believe in, some of the programs that we believe will be helpful in the future, particularly around positive behavior intervention and supports, restorative justice programs, and social-emotional learning. We really believe that we have, you know, a lot of children in K through 3 who are suspended. We're not teaching them anything. We're not getting to the underlying issues, and that's something that I hope we really are able to address this session. But I really appreciate this committee's longstanding interest in children's mental health and really understanding that if we don't treat their mental illness, they won't do well in school. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Abderholden. Sandra Samuels from the North Side Achievement Zone, and I'm not sure if someone's here from St. Paul, too, or...
No.
You're doing it all. Very good. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sandra Samuels, and I am President and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone. And I have the good fortune of being here today on behalf of the Education Partnership Coalition. The coalition is a group of six collective impact organizations across Minnesota. The members include St. Paul, Promise Neighborhood, Every Hand Joined, in Red Wing, the Northside Achievement Zone in Minneapolis, Northfield Promise, Austin Aspires, and Partner for Student Success in the St. Cloud area. We have an amazing state, and these are amazing organizations. You have a handout that really describes what we are doing together. Six communities, we're reaching 61,000 youth. And our goal is really what it says here, establishing a statewide network of comprehensive educational partnerships that emphasize local solutions and results-based accountability to close the opportunity gap in education. And again, I want to stress what it says here with the arrows. We are results-driven. We are created based on local partnerships. We have a holistic approach. Many of us have a two-generation approach, working with the most at-risk children, but their parents also, and continuous support for the time that's needed. And we are together seeing amazing outcomes. And, you know, I'll tell you, it really has everything to do with three things. One, what we've been doing as a state to eradicate the achievement gap hasn't worked. Been some amazing efforts. I've been a part of them for quite some time, but they just really haven't worked. And what we know is that schools can't do it alone. They need the entire community to come around them with support. And the two-generation approach makes a huge difference because, you know, many countries call teachers our nation builders. But, you know, the first nation builders are the parents. And by, like what we're doing in the Northside Achievement Zone, we're working with about 1,300 parents, all low income, making 73% make $19,000 or less. And we are circling them with housing support, career support, health support, so that the babies and children can do the two things kids should do, only learn and have fun. And so we have early childhood partners, which is a key part of our strategy. The scholarships make all the difference, as well as the mixed delivery system with schools, too. We're working in 9 schools with mentoring organizations, colleges. After school time is paramount. And what we're finding is that the customized, layered approach with the same families and same children based on what they need between all 43 of our partners in the Northside Achievement Zone is making a statistically significant difference in the kids who are in NAS who are ready for kindergarten. And I'll provide you through the session with a lot of data because that's we live by it. Kids who are ready for kindergarten and those who are not, and there's a big difference between those who are in NAS and who are not, also on third through fifth grade reading. And so we see some incredibly promising data as well as our other partners. And we believe that this is really the right approach for the state. And look forward to your partnership, hopefully, throughout this session. And I just want to close by saying one thing that we're doing as a state, and I love Minnesota. I love the cold. And I love our partners. And one of the things that we're all doing across the state is really being hope dealers, really instilling belief in ourselves, in the other adults, in parents themselves, in the children, that we do have brilliance in our communities. And there are just some families who are far behind and need a little extra support. Many of you who've been on the committee before, Sandra, Representative Erickson, I know you've seen it, but we give these to all of our babies when the parents graduate from our college family college-bound babies program. And this is the year our youngest will graduate from a four-year college. And we're also, there are about 500 parents that have lawn signs that say a North Side college graduate lives here. And I got to tell you, it's making a huge difference in the minds and the hearts and the belief of us all Thank you.
Thank you very much, and an excellent act out. Louise Sundin. And Ms. Sundin, I have to confess, I'm not sure who you're representing today. That's okay. You've been here so many times and so many years. So I look forward to newness. And please say your name for the record and begin.
And here we go again, Madam Chair. It's wonderful to have you, as always, in the leadership. My name is Louise Sundin, and in this room, I'm representing the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. Those are the teachers and the education support professionals in the Minneapolis schools. There's about 5,000 of them, and they are in the eye of the storm. So I am a little biased, but I think all of you that are on education committees are the ones who have the best job in the legislature, and that is really shaping and looking after our children, our future. So I commend all of you who are new to the committee. There's many of you. We look forward to getting to know you and working with you. I don't want to one-up, well, maybe I do, another organization that on Tuesday said that they were coming up on their 100th anniversary. They began in 1920. I want to say that the Minneapolis Local was born April 2nd, 1919. Huh? So we win. And we also want, I want you to know that in the intervening 98 years, we have been known and our educators have been known as a group who have always used courage and innovation all those years to try to lead the profession. When the union was formed in 1919, they quickly affiliated with the Minneapolis Central Labor Union at that time. And in the Minneapolis Tribune, there were 36-point type headlines that said, "Ladies, don't do it." Well, they did affiliate with the rest of workers, and we've been proud to be a part of the labor movement since. Now, I won't list all of our firsts. We have state firsts and national firsts to our credit, and there's about 20 of them I thought of off the top of my head, but I'll just emphasize a couple here and then just a couple of our legislative goals for this session. We were first in the state for sabbatical leaves. We were first pension, first mentor program, first pervasive peer review program, achievement of tenure process, in which we have a rigorous 3-year process that our teachers are required to go through in order for their colleagues to deem them ready to become more permanent members of our profession. A dozen professional practice schools, professional development centers. We were the first when Governor Pawlenty invented QCOMP to raise our hands and say, send us in, coach. We'll be the first to try it out, and we've been there ever since. We pioneered alternative licensure programs that are the Q programs and the Grow Your Own programs. Have some working now that you have funded, and we'd like you to expand. There, we can all do more of the Grow Your Own programs and the Quality Urban Educator programs. The Leadership Degree programs, Teacher of Color Support Network program, Labor Management Committee to professionalize teaching into a true profession, Career and Teaching Ladder. But the last two are kind of the ones I want to emphasize. At Patrick Henry High School, they still have a professional practice school that is very successful, and it relied originally on some legislation that you have that's still on the books for residencies. Residencies are first year years spent in a program where 80% of their time is spent teaching, 20% of time with a skilled mentor, and when they're through with that first-year program, every single administrator who receives one of those teachers from that residency rave about their ability to start teaching and hit the ground running. And that program, I think we could expand and maybe incent a little across the state. So that brings, of course, us to the teacher shortage. And the other program I wanted to mention is something called a teaching magnet. It used to be that there were federal grants for magnet programs. We got one some years ago, and the teaching magnet actually attracts middle grades, youngsters who think they might be interested in educating others. They are thinking about it that early because we help them do buddy programs with elementary kids to help them, you know, mentor them and grow, and that fans the flames of their interest in education. Then they transfer to the teaching magnet. The teaching magnet, they get in their years there college credit so that they can again start college then for their licensure program in college with a leg up. And I thought maybe as long as federal magnet grants don't exist anymore, why not state magnet grants for a teaching magnet? That's an idea I hope you plant here. I think we also need to think that a part of the shortage is maybe a shortage of schools where professional culture at the worksite is really extraordinarily supportive and understanding of the folks coming in. Teaching and teachers need to be valued and they need to be respected in order to want to be one. And so if we're going to attract our millennials into this business, we can't continue the external blaming and shaming and attack that they really hangs on. As much as I know, nobody in this room adds to that. But it still is something we have to all work at overcoming. So the paperwork overburden and the program overburden is part of the difficulty because they leave early because with the program on top of program on top of program, they all say nobody ever takes anything off the plate. And that's true. So we can all think about that together. I think ESSA gives you the opportunity to reduce some of that overburden. It gives you flexibility. So I hope you think through how we allow teachers to have the time and the focus so that they can, they just say all the time, just let us teach. I think also along with the teaching magnet, we might be able to think a little bit about a little incentive for future Teachers of America clubs or maybe future Teachers of Minnesota clubs. And that used to be kind of a hot number. And anytime you can get a youngster involved in a club, you know, with a jacket or a T-shirt, or, you know, it helps them support each other, thinking about that as something to do with their lives. We pioneered the Grow Your Own and the Q programs, as I mentioned, for persons of color. And I think we've actually added over 500 educators of color through those programs. They work. They can be expanded. And also, when we think about the millennials coming in, I think we might have maybe one or so on the tour on the committee here. What do they want to do? They really are the generation that evidently is going to save us because they're the fourth generation from the great generation. And they want to give back. They're caring. They want to make a difference. They like titles. They also don't want to be made fun of by their friends who, when they realize how little they're going to make and how maybe little they are supported and respected. So the full-service community schools is another quickie, and that is the wraparound services in full-service community schools to meet all the needs, not just of the whole child, but of the whole family and the whole community. And those full-service community schools, we have great ones, examples in the States. You've had them here testifying. We could use some more small funding. It doesn't take much to hire coordinators to get more who are on the waiting list who want to do that, all the way from after-school programs to free lunches for senior citizens in the community to come in. Pre-K, that's kind of all I have to say, is expanding the funding so that the school districts that are already on the waiting list already want to do it, so that they will find, and they have, superintendents have said, they will find the space. Just support the skilled master's degree educators who will help families and the kiddies get ready for K. Social-emotional learning, you may hear about this session. Social-emotional learning programs in training teachers and programs in schools, we have been emphasizing in the Great Lakes Teacher Union Reform Network, because there are really good social-emotional development programs in schools around the country. And when we bring teams of labor management teams in to hear about them, they're excited about the results. They work. They're great. And so whatever we can do to incent some training and some try out some pilot programs on social-emotional learning, it helps. And finally, career and tech ed. You know what NCLB did to K-12 career and tech ed. It killed it. And so we need some more maybe incentive for the partnerships between the K-12 schools and the community technical colleges. There's many of them in the state. There needs to be more. And the career and tech ed programs that you have expanded access to through the 9th and 10th graders being able to do that is terrific. But we need to fix one PSEO issue, and that is that ruling by the Higher Ed Commission that now is really putting a crimp into the instructors, both from the higher ed institutions and the K-12. If I had my druthers, I'd ask you to tell the Higher Ed Commission to stuff it and do a Minnesota override. I don't know whether you can do that or not, but you could try. Who'd stop you? And so that the K-12 teachers and the instructors in the tech colleges could continue to do what they have done up to now, which is teach together and teach each other's students. So that's enough for the time being. Again, we look forward to working with all of you. If you any of these ideas have created a little percolating in your head, we would love to tell you about our experience and what we think it'll take to incent some more. So let's let them teach, and let's try to emphasize their professionalism. Thank you very much.
Sundin. Charter schools, did you want to come forward, Mr. Piccolo, to introduce yourself so they know who's in charge of the charter school organization, the major one? Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, it's good to see you again, and members. My name is Eugene Piccolo. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. As was mentioned in the presentation earlier, there are 165 charter schools now in Minnesota, enrolling about 51,000 students, or about 7% of all the public school students in the state of Minnesota. Most of the charter schools are in the metro area, but we do have charter schools from Grand Portage in the far northeast, to Bemidji in the northwest, to Echo, Minnesota in the southwest, to La Crescent in the southeast, and schools all around. As an association, our commitment is to focus on ensuring that our schools are accountable, quality, and innovative. And just to share one thing, this is the 25th anniversary of Minnesota leading the charter school initiative in the country. And the charter school idea has now gone to 43 states and the District of Columbia, and also to foreign countries. Just a month ago, we had 12 school directors from Brazil charter schools. They were here on a State Department education program, and we spent a couple hours talking about charter schools in Brazil and here. And next week, we have officials from the ministries of education from the Czech and Slovak Republic coming to learn about charter schools. So we have, Minnesota has kind of been the state that's seen as the leader, and we have the best charter school law in the country because of the action of this legislature over the years. And so we will be coming forward with some issues in terms of accountability and transparency. We have always come forth to this legislature with ideas to make sure our schools are transparent and accountable, and also a few things in terms of innovation. So thank you.
Thank you. And with School Choice Week coming up soon, we'll be honoring you. So thank you very much,
you.
Mr. Piccolo. Shep Harris, and Nancy Hilden, I think you just wanted to introduce yourselves so that members know who you are. If you could say your name for the record and be a little brief.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Shep Harris with Fredrickson and Byron. I am here representing the International Education Center.
Yes, and I'm here on behalf of the American Indian OIC and Northwest Indian Community Development Center based in Bemidji. Nancy Hilden.
And Madam Chair, just I want to thank Ms. Munyon for mentioning our names. We represent two community-based organizations that are adult basic education providers that don't necessarily fit very nicely into the current ABE funding formula, and so we've been having some good productive conversations with the Literacy Action Network and with the Community Education Association, as well as other stakeholders, and we hopefully will bring a proposal forward to you soon where there'll be peace in the valley and everyone will be singing Kumbaya and smiling.
Oh, we look forward to that.
I do. And Madam Chair, if you don't mind, just for a brief moment, I just also wanted to mention to members that I also represent the Minnesota Association of Independent Schools. Mm-hmm. Ms. Perra did a nice job of describing what the department does. The Education Department also has a relationship with non-public education institutions through their Non-Public Education Council, and the schools that I represent vary from Duluth, the Marshall School up in Duluth, all the way down to Shattuck St. Mary's in Faribault, and in between, like Blake, Breck, St. Paul Academy. And in general, we look forward to working with you. I know there will be a number of issues where we, our coalition looks to preserve the independent status of the schools. So thank you for your time.
Appreciate thank you it. Very much. Ms. Hilden?
Yep. Nancy Hilden, if I can just add a little bit of context, Dr. Joe Hobart could not be here today, but he's the CEO of the American Indian OIC, and he's very pleased to report that they had a record number of graduates from their ABE program last year, 71. And this is in conjunction, and they're the only regional ABE consortium in the state. And what happens a lot of times is that students migrate between the reservation communities and then back to the urban core, and if you don't have some way to connect those students with organizations that they trust, they just fall back off. And so they've been doing some very good collaborative work now and keeping those students in that program and getting them to complete. So it's a very successful program.
Ms. Hilden, is that mostly with White Earth, or is it across the spectrum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's basically through the Northwestern Indian Community Development Center based in Bemidji. So it's Red Lake, Leech Lake. I want to say there's some White Earth, but I would say it's primarily Red Lake.
Excellent. Thank you. Is there anyone else from an organization before I call in Mr. Heller who would like to introduce yourself? Okay, then, Mr. Heller, welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and your representation.
Thank you, Representative Sandra Erickson, Chair on Education Innovation Policy Committee on the 11th of January 2017. My name is Rick Heller, and I officially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. Twice exceptional is not defined. It's found in Minnesota Statute 120B-15. And that's gifted and talented student programs. The print disabled was found in a federal act when they place it in there with the word opportunity, called the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2014. There's two types of lifetime handicapped learners only noted in that act: blindness and print disability. I currently have a handout. It is online, but I'm currently working with the United States Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights. I would ask that I could be provided that, because currently the document is not fully accessible in the public domain. Could I provide that to this committee today with permission from the chair?
Well, do you have it printed out professionally?
I'm not professional, but I do have it printed out. And I provided you one early today.
Well, during the meeting. The page, and we'll make sure we put it in the folders. Thank you.
Once I get it fully accessible, I'd ask that that be posted part of the minutes, and the minutes would reflect that I had a handout from that office. Once I get a fully accessible docket from the United States Department of Education, I'll provide it to you so the public can acquire this in an effective way based on American Disability Act Section 508, which they are required to be complied to. Minnesota in 2009 passed a statute called 16E03, which goes even further than that. It has to do with how technology will access content. And that has to do with what's called Refresh 508, which pulls Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.0 AA, and there's AAA, by the way, to ask state agencies to make stuff more accessible for fairness and sameness for the public domain as it relates to electronic data. In 2010, when I'm going to go a little brief about who I am. In 2010, when I found out my computer could read to me, I quit falling asleep, and then I started becoming a student. And that got me civically engaged in this process. Also, I've been working with the Minnesota Legislature, and if you go to Data Practice Committee, I testified the last committee of last year, and how the legislature is even working on equality and equity or fairness and sameness as it relates to how individuals that are blind can access our current laws that are put online so they can have struck through an underlined or underscored language read out loud with their specialty software that they put in place at the library upstairs in this building, which will read again struck through an underlined language out loud so they know in fairness and sameness what these bills have the potential of doing to becoming law. And the whole thing, when I come here, The end goal of this is that all students have global success. And if it's true that there's only two types of lifetime handicapped learners found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008, then we are to provide, again, equity and equality for those individuals. This bill that Mr. Weaver was kind enough to put last year, even though it's dead, if anybody's writing anything down or recording this, it's Senate File 3597, and I have a colored handout, but there's really not a comprehensive summary of what the bill does. But it actually, interesting enough, reflects the governor's proclamation that he put out in for the Gifted and Talented Youth Week in November 6th and 12th, which is the office of secretary. Just as the first one that became fully accessible, they have exempt themselves from that statute, 16E03. However, in that one, on second line, if I may read it, it's only a two-liner, under the State of Minnesota Proclamation, quote, education should foster development of leadership skills, creativity, academic abilities, and artistic talents. The bill that is still dead, I'm looking for someone to have a discussion with me about it, so I can get the content online of a detail about what it's going to do, but it breaks out the domains of gifted. Frankly, I don't know if it's how important it is to identify giftedness, but according to the United States Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights, they're tracking how many special ed kids and 504 kids which don't become eligible or labeled with a disability. That these are the gifted students that have the highest potential ability to become community experts on the Board of Teaching, through the Board of Teaching. The piece of this is I have a concern with two rules, and I'm going to stop after that, because the rules for these committees with the legislature need to be timely, transparent, and fully accessible for the public. Currently, bills that are in PDF, they have structured language, including rules for the Department of Teaching, are not fully accessible. Not equal or equality or sameness and fairness to individuals that access. The last set of rules are SONAR rules. The Department of Teaching is not compliant, but the legislature is more compliant now. The Board of Teaching or anybody, or any state agency who writes a rule, that because they're in PDFs, and structural language online language is not addressed. So it's up to the leaders to do anything with this. All I can do is provide this information to you. If you want to provide timely, transparent, and fully accessible, including tagged images for the blind, provides a level playing field for everybody to provide appropriate outcomes for what they want to do in the future, not just in future education, but from employment for independent living. If you have any questions, I'm welcome to it. Thank you again for this time to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Howland. We continue to work on that issue. As you know, the department has worked very hard to comply, and so has this legislature. So thank you very much.
I only have one question. If the chair will yield to it.
No, Mr. Howland, you're excused.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from members? I look forward to seeing you if you can be excused from your 1 o'clock. And I understand, you know, if you can't or don't want to be, that is fine. But it'll be a very interesting presentation, I know, from the Department of Education. Right, Mr. Rooney? We look forward to hearing from the commissioner. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.